Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, the home of the secret rulers of the Western world, no less. You won't hear this on the BBC. Marco Verhey and I have a conversation outside the Bilderberg Hotel in Arnhem. He's from We Are Change Rotterdam and studies this enormously powerful think tank, which controls most of the money in the Western world. It started in 1954, 10 years after a battle in the same spot at Arnhem was a Nazi victory. Also, Elizabeth Woodworth. She's the author of 9/11 Unmasked, the International Review Panel Investigate 9/11. Now, this is slated as the definitive investigation into what really happened on the 9/11 attacks. She's also writing about climate change, too. Also, an update from Fran Mayer, the latest on her employment support allowance claim. Well, she had to have it reviewed. And the various people assessing her seem to think that she's perfectly mobile, even though when she comes into the studio, it takes us nearly a quarter of an hour to get in here, and she has to move around on crutches. They think she doesn't need them. The bullying of disabled people is becoming de rigueur, the normal, at the Department for Work and Pensions. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk, based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you've got a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name is Marco Verhey, and we're here at the Bilderberg Hotel in Oosterbeek.
So what's the significance of this place? I know you're going to be doing a short talk about it tomorrow.
The significance, of course, is that at this hotel was the first Bilderberg meeting in 1954.
Why are you interested in Bilderberg, and why was it here?
Bilderberg is very intriguing because it had royalty, it had the top of NATO, businessmen. It's got all sorts of people involved. It's very interesting to have a look at what is going on there. So they're keeping it secret. That also ignites the imagination. So people come up with theories and conspiracies and yeah.
What's the relationship with government, because we like to think the government's in charge, but we also, in the back of our minds, we know that the rich and the powerful are out there too, big business and banks.
Yeah, I think that that is called the deep state, the power behind the government, and that's where you get into secret services. That's why I think that those secret services got together and organized this.
Now, as a movement within the NATO countries after World War II, why Holland? Why should something like that start in Holland? Surely just as easily in France, Britain, Germany or another country?
The person that was mentioned first is, of course, Jozef Ratinger, who is a Polish guy. He was in London in the war and he met Paul Reikens, who was the number one of Unilever. And they got together in London, and after the war, when Ratinger had his plan, he contacted Paul Reikens, and Paul Reikens was really into this idea of getting together in a casual way. And so he contacted Prince Bernhard, who I think chose the location.
Why do you think that? Why here? Yeah.
I think that because he had experience here. He was here before the war even. So
he married into the Dutch royal family in 1937, only 2 years before the Second World War started, but he'd come from a German aristocracy in Bavaria originally, and he was in the Nazi party, the SS. I mean, he seemed to have a foot in both camps almost.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, no, definitely. He's a guy where you go like, hey, you were in both camps. Definitely.
Yeah, but you see, also, you should say the same about companies like Unilever and Shell.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's where you go to say the public is being told one story, but behind the scenes there's intrigues going on and there's friends that supposed to be enemies. It's all very confusing.
So tell us a bit about Unilever. What kind of business is it and where was it based and how was it involved in Bilderberg?
Yeah, from what I can remember is that in the early 20th century already, there was this the Lever brothers in London, and there was a company here that got together. Paul Rijkens, who was at the start of the Bilderberg, I think went to London in very early in the 20th century and stayed there for a couple of decades. The company is into soap and into food. It's got loads of branches that it was into. I even remember Paul Rijkens going to Nazi Germany and writing about it afterwards, and that he had to do the Hitler salute, and that he said that he was doubting, but then he did it because he would have been the only one that was not doing it. And he was there for negotiations with Hitler and with Goering, and with Goering he got together to make a plan to build this huge whaling ship that went into the South Atlantic.
Interesting business, because even though Unilever owns hundreds of brands still to this day, it's not a company that we necessarily know even exists in the background.
Mm-hmm. You know that it's Unilever. If you look at the package, there is a U, a big U, that consists of several symbols. Yeah. That's how you can recognize a Unilever product.
That sounds like a code.
Yeah, no, it is.
They don't write Unilever. It's just a little code where if you're in the know, you know that it's a Unilever product.
Yeah, but it's their logo. Yeah, so.
Okay, so what about the significance of these kind of big corporations that are maybe not necessarily well known to the public, but they are really not national anymore. Of course, they're transnational. In fact, they're even on both sides in the Second World War.
Yes, exactly. And then their ties to the government is huge. They, you can say that these multinationals, here in Holland, we had our Prinsjesdag a few days ago, where we were only talking about dividend tax. Yeah, because this is something that the multinationals want to get rid of. The government is trying to get rid of because their friends are the multinationals. And when the people say, no, we want to keep it, then they say, no, that's populist. We don't want that. We work for multinationals.
What is this tax?
I'm not really an expert on that. I'm sorry.
What's the significance of Bilderberg today? Because it started 10 years after the Second World War, 1954, after the 10 years after the battle here anyway in Arnhem, but it's still going, isn't it? It's still going strong. Every summer, well, May, June time, there's a big meeting, 120 of the richest, most powerful people in the Western world, and apparently it's the place to be. If you're a politician or maybe an academic and you get invited here, what they say in The Economist is there's no more above this. You've reached the top.
Could be, for that sort of region in the pyramid. I think it's not really the top. It is just below the top. So there is a chance for people from below that to get into that region of power. So it's a big career chance for people. But also there's a big networking event going on at Bilderberg. And of course, what I think is that Bilderberg introduces trends. So all participants are told that there's a certain future that is ahead of them, that cannot be avoided, that they call them trends, and that they can take this information to their own country and take advantage of it so that they can fulfill the Bilderberg agenda, I guess.
What would you make of the appearance of people like Amazon, LinkedIn, Twitter, Google, PayPal, these real big tech giants, the ones that we're having so many problems with at the moment, for example, with avoiding tax? They seem to be very good at it, and no one manages to pin them down. You try and get them in one country, suddenly they disappear, they pop up in another country. What's the significance of people like Google? Because they're very big at Bilderberg. In fact, many people, and even some of the sub projects of Google, like DeepMind, Palantir Technologies, these people all come to these meetings. So what does that tell us about the future?
Yeah, power. These are the companies that have a certain power because usually they have monopolies as well. So Bilderberg wants to invite them and make them part of Bilderberg. You can really see that with the person of Eric Schmidt of Google. He's been, one of the top guys in the steering committee of Bilderberg for years. These companies that Bilderberg wants to, they may have seen them at the start as a threat, so that they wanted to get them in to no longer make them a threat, but to make them friends, so they can both have this power of this monopoly that they have.
because for many years it's been associated with the press, Bilderberg. I mean, Google now is the press in many ways. People search for their news on Google and this sort of thing. So I was reading recently one of the first German participants in 1954 at Bilderberg was this guy, Rudolf Müller, who was the founder of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is one of the most powerful newspapers in the whole of Germany now. The German model of the media is very different to the UK. All our UK media is based in London, national and international media, whereas in Germany, most of the big cities have their own take on world affairs, and Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung is one in Frankfurt, but he was here. So what's the connection with the press, do you think?
With the press, it's very important to get their trends out for Bilderberg. So they don't want people to see alternatives to their trends. So they want their trends to be presented in the press as being something that cannot be avoided. So that's why it's very important to them. Yeah, the thing to me is, what I found strange is that from Germany, there's always these big press guys. But from Holland, there never are. It's been years, like decades ago, that somebody from the Dutch press came here. That to me, I still find interesting.
Well, why is that, do you think? Is it maybe that there is a culture in that they don't want the Dutch press to be commenting on it? Because it's something which is of a Dutch origin. And also there's a lot of controversy in Holland about Bernhard, who was the chairman for the first 20 years, the guy that was discredited in the Lockheed scandal, where he took $1 million bribe in order to get the Dutch Air Force to buy these Lockheed jets.
Yeah. And connecting to that is the story, I think, in 1961, there was somebody from Elsevier magazine here in Holland that wrote a piece which contained the words that Bernhard was at a very important meeting in Stockholm, which was the Bilderberg, but was not mentioned by that name. And that at this meeting, he was probably securing something for Unilever back in Papua New Guinea. He was probably making a deal there. That was published at the moment that Bilderberg came out. And then when Bernhard returned from the Bilderberg, he immediately attacked this journalist, saying, oh, how cheap of you to attack the royal family. You cannot do that. And all about Bilderberg, we should not make speculations about that. Yeah, and this subject was not discussed at Bilderberg. And from that point on, there's not much press going on. But even in the 50s, we look at our Dutch newspaper, De Waarheid, which is Pravda in Holland. They had really good pieces on Bilderberg, wrote about the industrialists that came there. Not the other papers. All the other papers had very short articles where it only said Prince Bernhard has returned from the Bilderberg. That's all it said. And then when we get to the 70s, there was a lot of attention. But then in the 80s, there's almost no attention in the newspapers about Bilderberg, not in the 90s and not afterwards.
So why?
Why? They don't want it. They don't want that attention.
They actually, maybe, I think Holland is the Bilderberg soft underbelly that we need to prod to make sure that the Dutch, at least, if they can understand what's been going on here, maybe they will be more questioning of the so-called democracy we've got in Europe. You think that's maybe why they're so nervous about the press here in Holland?
I don't know. I hope so. But I don't have high expectations.
What about the word Bilderberg? Because, you know, as a Dutch person, you'll understand, I think, a lot more about what that word actually means. Because it's not just about this hotel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mansion that was built here in the early 20th century was called the Bilderberg. And then it was a privately owned mansion. When it got into the hands of this hotel chain, they kept the name. The name can be, I think, going back to the German language, can be translated into words. Bild is an image, and then Berg is a mountain, so a mountain of images.
Picture mountain.
Yeah.
Any other sort of other words which have other meanings, the Bilderberg expression?
Yeah, I'm thinking about Bildung, which is like education. So that is interesting as well. There's a lot of tastes and suggestions going on why Prince Bernhard took this location as the first conference meeting.
But he knew the place, so he probably liked the place. What about ownership of it? And I remember you were saying that at one point this hotel was abandoned and, you know, a place for squatters.
Yeah, it was suggested in a newspaper, I think the early 80s, that this hotel would be something for squatters, yeah. And that at one time this used to be such a prestigious hotel. But, I mean, Tony, you had a look around. It does not look impressive, does it?
Well, it's an expensive hotel, and it's got some quite expensive trimmings, but they don't have much in the way of a groundsman here. I mean, it's a bit rough around the edges.
Yeah, not what you would expect with an image and a reputation, a name like that, Bilderberg, definitely.
And what amazes me is they're letting people park on the grass. They've got a beautiful lawn, but the cars are parking on the lawn, which doesn't seem quite a bit tasteless.
Yeah, I even saw this picture from the 70s where they had cars on the lawn in front. Amazing.
All right, so where is a good place, do you think, for people to find out more about this Bilderberg conference? Every year, pretty much, there's a group of bloggers, journalists, activists that go to the conferences.
Of course, they need to go to wearechange.nl or wearechangerotterdam on YouTube.
And is that all in Dutch or is it a bit of English too?
Whenever we go to Bilderberg, we try to do everything in English, except if it gets to a specific Dutch topic.
And I know also you've been at this event here in Holland over the last few days where you are able to stick your camera in the face of a few Dutch politicians.
Definitely.
How did you get on?
Yeah, no, we were very successful. We had, I think, 13 people we confronted or interviewed. And that was really good. We
had ministers, yeah?
Yeah, Minister of Justice, Mr. Grapperhaus. We got the Minister of the Interior, Mrs. Ollongren, who is a Bilderberger. I got another Bilderberger, Mr. Pechtold of the Democrats. So there's the Minister of Justice, Mr. Grapperhaus. We got the Minister of the Interior, Mrs. Ollongren, who is a Bilderberger. We got the Minister for Economics, I think. And yeah, we got some parliamentarians and we asked them about this dividend tax. And our main question was, who do you work for? And it was amazing to hear the answers because some of these people actually answered that they work for themselves. Yeah, they call themselves representatives. Yeah.
So they're a minister, a private industry, all wrapped into one.
Who knows? Yeah.
Just give us the website again so people can find those.
That's wearechange.nl or on YouTube, look for We Are Change Rotterdam.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Elizabeth Woodworth, and I'm retired health sciences librarian. I worked for the British Columbia government for 25 years as the head librarian. And since I retired in 2002, I've been working on climate change and 9/11, the two things I feel are very strongly linked together. The problems are, of climate change are caused by the energy issues that 9/11 is also about.
Okay, before we start, can you just explain this link between 9/11 and climate change? That's the first time I've heard about that. Can you explain the link?
Well, not everybody talks about this link, but I believe there is a link between the drive for energy, global domination, which the United States has been after for decades. And so the 9/11 attacks created consensus for the U.S. to go into the Middle East after terrorists. And that's a decoy, basically. And the fact that climate science isn't covered by the mainstream media and the solutions to it are not covered is also because the fossil fuel companies and the automotive companies do most of the advertising in the media, because in the Fortune 500 companies, the list of companies, in the top 10, 7 of them are automotive and oil companies. So the media really doesn't, they talk about extreme weather, but they don't talk about the solutions to climate change. And there are many. And I've written a separate book this year on that subject.
Okay,
too.
But before we talk about your most recent book, can you give us the title of that book and take us through it just for 5 minutes?
Well, that's Unprecedented Crime, Climate Science Denial, and Game Changers for Survival. And I wrote that with Dr. Peter Carter, who lives in Canada too. He's a medical doctor, and he's been researching climate science for 30 years. And we wrote the book last year, and I took the book to Bonn, Germany, to show it to Dr. James Hansen, who's the foremost climate scientist in the world, having blown the whistle in 1988 in Congress. And Dr. Hansen agreed to write the foreword because Dr. Carter is an expert reviewer for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So that book, it's the first full book, you know, respectable book, documented, that has treated climate science denial as a crime against humanity. And we make that case for the first third of the book. And then in the second third of the, two-thirds of the book, we report the solutions that are being raised all over the planet. I mean, Morocco, they've got the world's largest concentrated solar plant. And Spain has the same technology. They can smelt steel with the energy that comes from concentrated solar power. We never hear about that in North America. The media will not talk about
it. I mean, I think what you very rarely hear about are the sorts of changes that we need to make, humanity needs to make, in order to become less reliant on energy generally, but mostly fossil fuels. So, I mean, that's just one example, this ability to smelt steel using solar power, which I'd never heard of. You're quite right. Can you take us through a few more examples of the ways forward? Because we seem to spend a lot of energy moaning about climate change, but not enough saying, well, this is what we need to do.
There's so many forms of tidal power, for example, that we don't hear about. The geothermal energy is a huge possibility. We don't hear about that so much. In Canada, we have 60,000 oil wells, abandoned oil wells in Alberta, where the tar sands are. And at the bottom of all those wells, already drilled, is the potential to gather geothermal energy and feed it up to a grid. If the Canadian politicians had any imagination, they would be saying, let's create a smart grid for Canada, electric grid, and feed solar, wind, geothermal, and tidal energy into that grid and forget about the tar sands. But instead, the Canadian government has just bought a $4.5 billion pipeline from Kinder Morgan, which is an American company, to extract even more of this filthy tar sands oil for export.
Why do they carry on with this fossil fuel obsession? Why won't they embrace this new technology?
I think that the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, behind the scenes is unable to stand up to the big energy corporations. I think it's just political weakness.
Simple as that. Okay, well, what about the 9/11 book? What's the title of that and what inspired you to write it with David Ray Griffin?
Oh, the title of the book is 9/11 Unmasked, an international review panel investigation. And in 2011, 7 years ago, Dr. Griffin and I formed something called the 9/11 Consensus Panel. And we decided to use a best evidence model that is used in medicine. It's called the Delphi Method. And we invited about 25 panelists to join us in reviewing the official claims that have been made by the U.S. government and its agencies. And so we had 23 panelists signed on, and for 7 years, David and I have been formulating statements which first outline the official account, and then we outline the best evidence that we've been able to find that opposes that official account, and then we make a conclusion. And so each time we come up with a potential consensus point, we send that out to our 23 panelists, and they're not allowed to talk to each other. They're blind to one another. And so they each review the statement that we've come up with. Medicine does the same thing when they're forming consensus statements about medical topics. And then they review and send us our feedback. And then we incorporate that feedback into a second statement, send that back to the panel, and there's more feedback. And we'll do that three times. It takes several months to work through this process. And when all the panelists have reached a conclusion, or at least when 85% of them agree with the consensus point, we publish it. So we've been doing that. As I say, we've done 51 of these consensus points over 7 years. And finally, we decided it's time to publish these as a book. So we did. We transformed them into 51 chapters and interlink books. And I think they're in Boston. They have just brought the book out as of September 11th at the anniversary.
Well, it's easy to remember, 51, isn't it? That's the number of states in the United States of America, if you include Britain as one.
That's good. I've heard that one.
Anyway, can you just take us just through maybe four or five of the points, Elizabeth, and explain them to us that you've teased out? Because I think 51 is a lot, but I'm sure you're able to say, well, actually, these are a few of the main points for lay people looking at 9/11 that show that there's been a cover-up, effectively, that the investigation hasn't been thorough.
One of the most kind of interesting points to me is the military drills that were running that morning. The United States has these annual and biennial military drills, and they're really enormous, like Global Guardian, for example. And they plan that months in ahead, and they usually have it in late October. So what happened on 9/11 is that four massive annual military drills were rescheduled for the morning of September the 11th. And the official claim was that they did not interfere with the military response to the hijacked planes. And the 9/11 Commission never mentioned them, never mentioned the fact that these were running, except in one footnote at the back of the book, they referred to Vigilant Guardian, which was one of them. So the best evidence that we came up with was that 12 air drills in total were running the morning of a 9/11, and that included the two I've mentioned, plus Crown Vigilance and Amalgam Warrior. And seven of these had been rescheduled from late October, an enormous departure from other years. Some of the drills involved hijack simulations, and controllers were asking things like, is this real world or exercise? These are the FAA, FAA controllers. Is this real world or exercise? Radar screens were showing emergencies all over the place, and there were lots of false signals out there, they said. And there were 21 reports of hijacked planes. And the fighters that would normally go up to intercept the hijacked planes, they weren't in their usual locations, and they weren't able to respond. So the air defenses of America broke down. And we actually have a clip that Global Guardian, the biggest one, had been scheduled for late October. It was actually reported in one of their newsletters, Space Observer, on March 23rd. So whoever changed that massive exercise probably planned 9/11.
Okay, so the exercises is one. What about some more of those 51 points?
There's another one. I have these written up because I never be able to remember them otherwise. One official claim concerned steel from the World Trade Center number 7, which collapsed suddenly at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. This huge, massive 47-story steel and concrete building that was as large as a football field. I mean, a really massive thing. And so the official claim was that no steel was recovered from World Trade Center 7. So it was impossible to carry out any metal studies. So our best evidence shows that a Freedom of Information request to NIST in 2012 shows a photo of NIST engine, that's the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and they released the official reports on how the buildings fell, including World Trade Center 7. And NIST engineer Dr. John Gross is shown in a photograph standing on a pile of World Trade Center steel in a scrapyard. And a 2002 New York Times story noted that Perhaps the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation involves extremely thin bits of steel collected from the trade towers and from WTC-7. The steel apparently melted away, but no fire in any of the buildings was believed to be hot enough to melt steel outright. So our conclusion was, why did NIST lie? And we think that it was to destroy the evidence of controlled demolition. And it positioned itself to explain the collapse by resorting to a computer simulation into which variables were inserted. And it was not peer-reviewed, so this is what went down as their public explanation.
So do you have evidence for controlled demolition?
Yes, we do. Dr. Harrit, Niels Harrit, he's a retired nanochemistry professor from University of Copenhagen, and he and eight other professors in 2009 released a peer-reviewed study in the science literature showing that nanothermite was definitely used. Nanothermite is a substance that's not found in nature, and it's only made in U.S. Military laboratories, or at least it was at that time. And they found all kinds of it in the dust, these little red and gray chips, red on one side and gray on the other. And these little chips, at first they thought they were paint or something, but when they analyzed them chemically, they found out it was nanothermite.
So what is this stuff?
I'm not very good on chemistry, but your readers can look that up. They can look up the article by Niels Harrit, H-A-R-R-I-T, and Stephen Jones, and there were about seven other professors who explain about what it is. It burns really hot. It can be used to cut steel with a torch and that sort of thing.
So what about some of the other points of your 51?
Okay, there's another one that concerns the hijackers. The official claim was that an airport security video showed five hijackers at Dulles Airport in Washington before they were boarding Flight 77, which allegedly hit the Pentagon. And that video was not released until July 2004, the day before the 9/11 Commission report was released, this video that I just mentioned. And there were over 300 security cameras at Dulles International Airport on September 11th. And I found out recently that their images were painstakingly examined by an information systems technician who was monitored by federal agents. But from those 300 cameras, no images were released at the time of the attacks in 2001. Like, the only thing that they ever released was in 2004. And they never released a single time-stamped video or any of the images from these cameras. And the video released in 2004 was made by a much faster consumer video camera, 30 frames per second. Also, Dulles Airport staff made no positive identification of the hijackers. So that's another one. This man, Dave Brent, who examined all the footage from the 300 cameras, he said, after the 9/11 attacks, I was part of a team that had the laborious task of reviewing all the video from Dulles with several federal agents looking over our shoulders. Did you notice I said all the video? That's every frame from over 500 cameras with 30 days of retention time. The task took 3 weeks of 15-hour days. So they had no images. So there goes the hijacker story.
Well, so, I mean, that's devastating. How come we haven't really heard much about this in the mainstream press?
The same reason that we haven't heard about climate science, the solutions to the climate issue. The mainstream press wants us to keep using fossil fuels, and they don't want anybody to know about why we're really in the Middle East.
Okay, so the hijackers is another one. Amazing that they haven't got any pictures. What about the next one on the list of the 51?
Well, these are three Tony, that I have sort of pulled off the list so that I can kind of read from them. I don't have a fourth ready in that way, but I can say that the 51 points against the official claims fall into 9 categories, which I'll read those off. The destruction of the Twin Towers, the destruction of World Trade Center Building 7, the attack on the Pentagon, the 9/11 flights, U.S. military exercises on and before 9/11, which I mentioned one of those, claims about military and political leaders, the people who were in charge that day and where they were, Osama bin Laden and the hijackers, claims about them, claims about phone calls from the 9/11 flights. Most of them were said to have happened when the planes were much higher than a cell phone than a cell phone can make a connection to a tower on the ground. And the problem with that is they're so high that they're, by the time they're over the tower, the signal, or past the tower, the signal can't be maintained. And the last of the 9 categories was insider trading.
Can we just focus on that last one? Because I think this one is particularly fascinating. I can remember stories about the insider trading actually back around the time of the September the 11th attacks. I remember it was that someone had discovered that someone was doing these insider trades, but then the story went dead. It was almost like a loose end. We never heard about any investigation or who it was that had somehow, it looked like, known beforehand that, for example, American Airlines shares would be going down because they were one of the airlines involved in the 9/11 attacks and had somehow made a lot of money at it.
Yes, there was a lot of that thing going on, and the point that we made on this was written by an economist, Dr. Paul Zaremka, and it's quite a complex thing to prove or disprove that insider trading was actually happening, but the commission didn't show that there was no insider trading based on foreknowledge. It simply asserted that there was. So there are a number of, if people buy the book, they'll find a number of studies that were made in economics and commercial journals about those insider trading events.
What about your motivations personally, Elizabeth? I mean, why did you think that this was an important subject to write about, and what brought you to it originally?
I guess it was about April 2006 when I read David Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor. That book was handed to me by a good friend, a psychologist, and he just said, Elizabeth, I think you'd find this interesting. And I read it in a couple of days, and at the end of it, I just thought the way he laid it out was so inescapable that there had been an inside job, probably. And I just thought, this is not the world I thought we were living in. So I wrote a review for the New York Times because I couldn't find any reviews of the book. It was a 2004 book, and now it's 2006. So I looked for reviews because I'm a librarian, and there were no reviews. So I wrote a review, and then I wrote to the author, thinking I should tell him. In the review, I said that there was an illegal PDF online, like a pirated PDF. I was going to mention that in the review, but that's sort of against what librarians would like to do. So I wrote to him, David, and it's the first time we made contact, and he said, he forwarded that to his publisher and said, well, don't do that, but let me see your review. I'd be curious. And he thought it was a good review. And then he started asking me if I would like to proofread for him. So the first book that I proofread for him was Debunking 9/11 Debunking. And that was in late 2007. And that just started us together on a path that has now lasted 11 years. And we decided, you know, that to get all the different professions that are involved in exposing 9/11. Like, there are all kinds of intelligence officers and architects and engineers and lawyers, all kinds of people, bring them together into the consensus panel and see if we could get some kind of recognition through that work. So we think this, some people are saying now that this book, 9/11 Unmasked, is the best book on the subject, the most important subject of the 21st century. So we're glad to hear reviews like that.
How about the results today of the 9/11 attacks? Because this whole war on terror, or war on terrorism, or war of terror, depending on what you want to call it, doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. There's a tension ramping up between Israel and Iran. Everyone is accusing everyone else of being terrorists. And also in Syria, the final city of Idlib is being liberated, although some say, for example, on the news here, night after night we're hearing, oh, isn't it terrible the people in Idlib are being bombed? But of course, you know, this is a place which is being held by al-Nusra and various other jihadi groups, which the West seems these days to now think are worth supporting. So what do you think of where we've come since 9/11 on the war in the Middle East?
Well, I think that the do you remember seeing that 2.5 minutes by General Wesley Clark right after 9/11? He had retired, and he went into the Pentagon, and they told him that for some reason they were going to invade Iraq, and not only Iraq, but 7 other countries in the Middle East, and he listed them all. It's on YouTube. And I think that this basically from the start was about regime change in the Middle East. And possibly now, that's my personal opinion, I think that demonizing Putin, which is being done all over the place in the mainstream media, is part of possibly hoping to have regime change in Russia. Oliver Stone, last June, the Showtime series here in North America, they published 4 hours of interviews between Oliver Stone and Putin. And Oliver Stone had 21 hours of one-on-one interviews with Putin over the 15 months before June 2017. And they're extraordinary. I mean, what they show about Putin and his command of history and his perpetual sort of interest in the welfare of the people of Russia, you know, we would never have any of that given to us on the mainstream media, which is trying to demonize him. And I would recommend to everybody that you at least get the other side of the story about who Putin really is in one-on-one conversation. And Oliver Stone didn't let him off lightly. You know, he really went after him on certain things. So it wasn't a prejudiced type of interview.
Yeah, but what about the Middle East? What's going to happen there, do you think?
I don't know. You're not asking the right person, Tony. I'm no authority on the Middle East whatsoever. I hope that that Syria, that the U.S. will leave Syria alone. I think it's really time they did. I don't know if you've been following Piers Robinson and his group. They've been studying the Syria propaganda, and they have an online website. Dr. Piers Robinson, he's a professor of journalism at the University of Sheffield, and there are about 8 or 9 professors in the UK that are part of that group. They're also looking into 9/11, but for the moment they're looking into the Syria. They're trying to counter some of the stories from the White Helmets about chemical weapons attacks by the Syrian government against its own people. And it's kind of hard to believe that when you think that Assad is actually a medical doctor, and he went to study ophthalmology in England, where he married his wife, who is has won humanitarian awards for her work in France. I mean, you'll never hear that in the mainstream.
Is there any, is the book available? Because there was some sort of a hiccup. It didn't seem to be available, even though obviously there's all the talk of 9/11 around the September, as there was this year. Your book was due to be available, but it wasn't. What happened?
I don't know. There's been quite a lot of speculation, and the Off Guardian has been looking into this. And Ed Curtin, who's a professor of sociology in the United States, has been looking into it. all we know is that the book was declared on the Amazon website, Amazon.com, which is the U.S. one, as being released September 11th, the anniversary date. And on that date and the 2 days after that, when all the reviews were coming out, the Amazon website said out of print. And that is never used. I've never seen that used for a book that's coming into print. That's that. As a librarian, in 25 years, I never saw out of print except for books that whose copies had all been exhausted and they were no longer available from the publisher. So it said that for 2 days, and then it went to saying it will be available September 30th. Then it went to October 6th. Then it came back to September 24th. Then it was out of stock. So for anybody going to the website, they would be discouraged from purchasing it.
Is it available now? And if so, from where? And remind us of the title.
The title is 9/11 Unmasked, UNMASKED, an international review panel investigation. And it's available immediately from its publisher, Interlink Books, which is in the United States. On Amazon UK, it says the book usually ships within 1 to 3 months, which is not at all helpful. And in Canada, it says that the title has not yet been released. That's what Amazon says in Canada, where I am. So I think going to the publisher is the best bet.
Elizabeth Woodworth, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony, for having me. The pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Frances Meyer, and I was attacked in 2010, sustained broken hip, broken pelvis and broken upper femur. Initially, I got proper benefits, but then they decided they were going to mess me about by putting me through all kinds of assessments for personal independence payment, and more recently for employment support allowance, which they've withdrawn.
Well, just tell us a little bit about how you're now affected by this. I mean, it's 8 years ago,
yeah.
But how does this affect you day to day, this injury?
Well, I need a Zimmer frame to mobilise indoors, but since I live on the first floor, I can't take it downstairs with no lift. And outdoors, I use crutches, two crutches.
How easy is it for you to get up out of a chair or to sit down?
Depends on whether it's got arms on the side. It's still difficult with arms on the side, and I can just about get out of a chair that hasn't got arms, but that is very difficult, as you saw just a minute ago.
Well, no, we haven't got any arms on the chairs in here. No, it is awkward for you to move around, certainly. Now, this assessment, you had an assessment for ESA.
That's correct.
Which is employment support allowance. So the idea is, what's the point of that benefit?
The employment support allowance is designed to help people with disabilities find appropriate employment. But they've just taken it away from me because apparently I'm too fit now. I don't deserve it anymore.
Now, this assessment was done by down at Bristol Keys Assessment Centre, in the middle of August of you, and initially I think you were told that your money would be increasing.
That's correct.
Well, so then what happened?
So I went down the stairs to check my posts a couple of days later, and I found another letter there telling me the opposite, that they'd actually stopped it.
Okay, so that all happened around about mid-September.
Yeah.
You've then asked for a mandatory reconsideration because...
That's correct.
Obviously, you know, you are in a pretty difficult state of disability and you need help in order to find work. I mean, surely an employer is not necessarily going to employ somebody if they are constantly need to move around on crutches and can't get up and down from a chair unless it's got arms on, that sort of thing,
yeah,
is going to affect your employability, isn't it?
That's correct.
So what happened with the mandatory reconsideration then? Because you've just had the results through about that, haven't you?
Well, I didn't expect much from the government where that was concerned, but I certainly didn't expect to be turned down flat.
Now, you've brought in your Employment Support Allowance medical report which has been passed off by somebody called Mr. Stephen Cutler, who says he's a registered physiotherapist. I mean, obviously, he's not a doctor, he's a physiotherapist, so he's looking at your mobility. Amazingly, he's saying things like that you actually get using a stick rather than crutches. But do you ever use a stick?
Nope.
Because obviously a stick, it means you're much more able to move around. So anyway, so now you've been told by the mandatory reconsideration people that they've had another look, and yes, you are mobile. And I mean, how mobile are you?
Well, like I say, it's in my frame with a tray indoors, and then two crutches outdoors. I can manage with one crutch if I'm only going down to put my rubbish out into the bin outside and to come back in again. But if I'm walking any distance or if I've got to get up and down a curb, I need two crutches.
So the mandatory reconsideration is done by, let's have a look here, it's done by the Department for Work and Pensions. So yes, they're basically a bit like Saudi Arabia investigating the Khashoggi killing. They're investigating their own mistakes, and they've decided, funnily enough, that they didn't make a mistake. So what happens now, Fran?
Well, the only thing I can do now is to try and take it to appeal. And it might work, because it worked when they turned me down for PIP to start with, personal independence payment. But when it went to appeal, they overturned the decision, so I'm getting it now.
There are at least three quarters of these appeals are successful, which makes me wonder whether people like Mr. Stephen Cutler, registered physiotherapist at Bristol Keys Assessment Centre on the 6th of August 2018, actually knew what he was doing, since three quarters of the decisions made by these people are then overturned at appeal. Mm-hmm. Well, what's the point of making an assessment if it's just then going to be overturned eventually?
Exactly.
So what's it been for you not having this benefit? What's it been like?
Well, it's difficult. It's not impossible at the moment, because I've still got, as far as I'm aware, I've still got housing benefit, council tax benefit and PIP, but that isn't enough to live on.
So, yes, I hope you manage with the appeal, because if they're taking this away, that could be very difficult. Anyway, keep us in touch, Fran, will you?
Okay, I will do.
And keep us up to date with what happens. Okay. How does one go about doing an appeal? Do you know?
I had to go to a tribunal, which wasn't in Western Supermere. It was closer, but I can't remember exactly where. And Kat Venables from Ramos came there to support me.
What? Who are they?
It's an acronym for something, but I can't remember what. It's to do with disabilities, supporting people with disabilities. And she came to support me at the appeal, and we won. So I'm hoping the same will happen again.
Well, keep us informed, please, Fran, of what happens. It'll be very interesting to see how your case goes.
Okay, thank you.
And shame on you, Mr. Stephen Cutler, for getting it all wrong. Physiotherapist. Well, that's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast, if you like, online at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Marco Verhey from We Are Change Rotterdam, author of 9/11 Unmasked, Elizabeth Woodworth, and Fran Mayer, trying to get her legal right to employment support allowance. Also to studio engineer Dave Pazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.